garage and showed pretty much everything I'd seen when Guayota had come to visit. It also showed, to my relief, the dog changing into a man in the background while Guayota and I fought. She watched it from beginning to end, and her poker face was flawless. If I didn't know better, I'd have thought that she saw fights between volcano gods and mechanics on a daily basis. Her assistant, a bright young thing, had yet to acquire a mask that could cover her fascination.
"Good one," the assistant breathed at the point where I stuck the mop handle into his head.
It looked more disturbing on screen than it had been at the time. I suppose I'd been worried enough about survival to get too squicked then. When the disc finished, she added,
"You've done a lot of karate, right? That looked like an outtake from some of the old martial arts shows before they learned to get the actors to slow down so the audience could see what they were doing."
Jenny Trevelyan cleared her throat, gently. A light flush rose in her assistant's face. I hadn't caught her name, and now I regretted it because I liked her.
"Sorry, but you're lucky you survived. Seriously, that guy was scary."
Jenny folded her hands and stared at Adam. "Okay. What happened later that made you erase the end of the video?"
"An unfortunate glitch in the equipment," Adam murmured. "We have three discs from different cameras, but something, maybe the excess heat, made them all quit recording around the same time."
The lawyer's assistant, who was scribbling down notes, lit right up.
"Magic is supposed to affect electricity like that. I've read that wizards can't be in the same room with things like computers and stuff."
I knew where she'd read that. I bit my lip. It was to our advantage to spread a little misinformation whenever we could.
"Convenient as that explanation is," said Jenny dryly, "I would like to know what would happen if Cantrip magically figures out what the cameras would have shown if they hadn't glitched. I am your lawyer. I can't help you if I don't know the truth."
"Someone came in with Adam and saved my skin," I told her. "The means that someone used would make that someone very valuable to the military or any number of other disreputable types who might resort to kidnapping to get that kind of power under their control. I'm just glad that the glitch happened when it did. That way we can just give the credit to my husband and ensure that a good Samaritan doesn't suffer for saving my bacon. We'd like to leave that person out completely."
"Okay," she said. "If the opportunity comes up, I might remind Cantrip that there is already one video in existence showing exactly what Adam is capable of."
She wasn't looking at me, and I was glad. Adam had, in a graphic fashion, destroyed the body of the man who'd assaulted me. The video of that had been released so that neither Adam nor I was charged with murder. It was only supposed to go to certain people, but it had been seen more widely than it should have been. "And," she continued, "that a second example wasn't wanted. That way no one will be looking for another reason for the glitch. Is that acceptable?"
"Fine," said Adam.
"You gave me a brief statement before we watched the video. Now tell me again who this is that broke into the garage and why he attacked Mercy."
I folded my arms and put my forehead down on the desk while Adam talked. The next thing I knew, Adam had gathered my hair in one hand and tipped my head sideways. I blinked at him.
"She needs to see the burn on your face," Adam said.
It took me a moment to process what he said. Then I sat up and showed her myself. I showed her the burns on my hands and arms and the one on my ribs. I put bag balm on them and they felt better, despite what the EMT had said.
"You shot the dog first," Jenny said. "The one that, turned into a man? Then he threw some sort of fire magic at you and burned your cheek. That's not on the disc I saw, but Adam told me that it's on the second disc. Then you fired 5 times at him, 3 to the head, 2 to the chest. You jumped on the car, looking for a way out, and when it became obvious that there was nothing available, you engaged in battle with Juan Flores, who apparently is a Canary Islands volcano god named Guayota."
She was scary good. She got out the last part of the sentence without any inflection.
"Almost," said Adam. "First he broke into the garage with a crowbar. We have that caught on the outside camera."
She nodded.
"Okay, I'd like to wait until I've had a chance to review all the discs available. But, as you've pointed out, there is the worry that in the meantime some poor law enforcement officer will run into him without knowing what he is. We need to let the law enforcement agencies know what they might be dealing with. With that in mind, and with your permission, I'll send copies of the discs to the police immediately. And, I added, because it seemed an important part of the narrative, he admitted to me that he'd killed 7 women whose bodies were discovered yesterday. No, sorry. Just because I hadn't slept didn't mean the time hadn't passed. Her assistant handed me an ice-cold bottle of water. I took it and drank a quarter of it down. It was the day before yesterday, Thursday. The police took me out to the crime scene to see if werewolves were responsible for the massacre. Her right eyelid twitched.
That's the first I've heard of this.
When did he admit that? I didn't see it. That's the trouble in Finley I was talking about, I told her. She took in a deep breath. She made me go over all that I knew about the 7 women and assorted horses and dogs that Guayota had killed near the hayfield in Finley. At some point, her assistant took over the questioning, though I'm not sure she was supposed to.
You mean all the dead women looked like Mr. Hauptman's ex-wife? That's right out of a profiler's book.
Jenny snorted her coffee, wiped her nose, and gave her assistant a quelling look. You might curb your enthusiasm over the deaths of 7 women, Andrea. It isn't really appropriate.
Poor things, said Andrea obediently. But this is like being in the middle of an episode of Criminal Minds.
She paused.
Okay, that's dorky, sorry. But most of our cases are like somebody's kid got drunk and hit a fence and wants to make reparations but would rather not lose their driver's license. The only murders we've been involved with have been those everyone knows who did it, and our job is to get our client the lightest sentence possible. And I'm talking too much.
She blinked at us.
It's just that I moved here hoping I might get a chance to see a fae, because the reservation is just over in Walla Walla, and here I am talking to a werewolf about a fire demon who is killing people and burning down buildings.
Jenny covered her mouth, and when she pulled her hand away, her face was stern.
She actually is very, very good in court. Her voice became very dry as she said, You wouldn't recognize her. And in case you were worried, nothing comes out of her mouth in public that she doesn't want to say.
I am discreet, agreed Andrea.
So, Jenny said in a we're getting back to business manner, you want me to set up a meeting with Cantrip and the police?
That is correct,
Adam agreed. Okay, I'll get something set up for this afternoon, hopefully here, but probably down at the Kennewick police station. She looked at us and smiled. In the meantime, I suggest you get a few hours of sleep. In the end, we checked into a hotel. Honey's house was filling rapidly with even more pack members as a story about last night's fight got out. Sleeping there during the day was out of the question. Adam put us in the hotel nearest the airport. The room was clean and quiet, and for the 4 hours we were there, it was perfect for sleeping. Well, after we remembered to put out the Do Not Disturb sign, and after I put the fear of me into the second maid who apparently couldn't read the sign. I wasn't exactly chipper when we woke up to head into our afternoon appointment with Cantrip and the police, making a quick stop at the mall to grab clean and appropriate clothing. Apparently Cantrip was still jockeying for position and fighting with the local police, so our lawyer's office was acceptable neutral territory. The Cantrip agents, Orton and Kent, were waiting for us, smugness radiating off them both. Jenny and her assistant Andrea were there, along with a gray-haired man who was balding and so thin and fit that he must have made a real effort at keeping in shape. It was hard to tell for sure, but I thought he was maybe 20 years older than our lawyer, which would put him in his late 60s or early 70s. His face looked slightly familiar, and he exchanged courteous nods with Adam, so I assumed he was someone from the firm whom Adam knew. Jenny didn't introduce him beyond his name, Larry Torbett. Jenny gave us a small, controlled smile.
I suggest that we start. I have the originals of 3 discs from the security video at Mercy's garage from the night in question for you, gentlemen. I have copies for my files, and of course I have already sent copies over to the police as well. Detective Willis called to tell me that they found the video enlightening, but that they would, regrettably, be late. The outside camera clearly shows Mr. Flores, who is wanted in connection with murder and arson in Eugene, breaking into the garage with a crowbar after hours when only Ms. Hauptman was inside. The other two are views from 2 different cameras in the garage. I will show you one,
the one that shows more or less Ms. Hauptmann's view of the events. The last camera shows Ms. Hauptmann's actions better. They are time-stamped. At the conclusion of the video, Orton looked grimly satisfied, and the younger cantrip agent, Kent, triumphant, presumably because any altercation between the wife of a werewolf alpha and a fire demon put the case in their jurisdiction.
"Well," said Larry Torbett, "wasn't that something watching the agents come, Jenny?"
"There's more," she said. "There is no sound in this recording, and Miss Hauptmann has a lot of pertinent information that is not apparent. Miss Hauptmann?"
By this time I could have told the story in my sleep, but 4 hours of napping had removed that temptation. I told the whole thing from beginning to end. The cantrip agents didn't ask for any clarification, which bothered me. Only when I had finished entirely did the cantrip agent stir.
"Miss Hauptmann," said Agent Kent genially, "I know that you were on record any number of places stating that you are not a werewolf."
I narrowed my eyes at him.
"That's right."
He tapped the discs. "Are you human?"
"Are you?"
I asked.
"You move very well for a human," said Agent Kent, who didn't seem nervous or green today. The change was so great that I wondered if the appearance of being a rookie was one he used for effect.
"Thank you," I told him. "I'll tell Sensei that you were impressed."
"My wife takes lessons in Shisei Kaikan. Additionally, we spar in various styles several times a week. I do not intend that anyone hurt Mercedes again."
Adam's tone was cool, and the warning in his last sentence was clear to anyone who was listening.
"We're familiar with the alleged assault," said Agent Orton.
"Have you seen the security footage from that?" asked Torbett before Adam could speak.
I got my heel on Adam's foot, but he'd cooled off considerably and frowned at Torbett.
"No," said Orton. "However, I have."
The older man's voice was cool.
"I assure you that an assault took place and the bastard got what was coming to him."
It was nice that he agreed there had been an assault, but was there anyone in the whole world who hadn't seen me assaulted? Anyone except Orton, that is. Maybe we should have just put it up on YouTube. I forced my hands to unclench before anyone noticed.
"The issue remains," said Agent Kent, taking up the charge as the senior agent stalled out, "that we believe, Miss Hauptmann, that you have not been entirely forthcoming about whether or not you are human."
"Are you?" I asked again, because my nose told me that he was not.
"Yes," Kent said, believing he told the truth. "How about you, Miss Hauptmann?"
"No, you aren't," said Adam, intrigued.
His head tilted, and he took a deep breath, so everyone would know what sense he was using to determine it.
"Fay, though you aren't even a half-blood, maybe one of your parents?"
Agent Kent just stared at him. "You might talk to them and ask," I suggested. "Do you have trouble with metals?"
"I have a nickel allergy," he said defensively.
"This isn't about Agent Kent."
Orton had had time to recover. "We've determined that Miss Hauptmann is a potential threat to the public safety, and we are bringing her in as a murder suspect who has supernatural powers that make her too dangerous to be incarcerated in the usual ways."
"Under what authority?" asked Jenny.
"Under the Humanity Act that established the agency I work for, Ms. Trevelyan, and the discretionary detention provisions in the Patriot Act. We can detain Miss Hauptmann indefinitely as a possible terrorist."
Orton's tones were smug. I wasn't afraid of their taking me, but I was terrified of what Adam would do to ensure that they did not. Adam, though, wasn't tense at all. I frowned at him. Why wasn't he upset?
"Are you acting on your own, sir?" asked Larry Torbett.
"I have my orders," said Orton repressively. "Miss Hauptmann, you aren't going to give us any trouble here, right?"
"I'm not," I said, still watching my husband, who seemed pleased. "But I wouldn't go counting your prisoners before they are safely in your detention cell." Larry Torbett smiled at me.
"Well said, Miss Hauptmann. Mr. Hauptmann, you should know that I have in my possession documentation that someone in high places would like a pet werewolf and was not opposed to kidnapping to achieve his desires. How presumptuous of him to try to use the law to enable him to do so. Who is your supervisory agent, Agent Orton?"
Orton frowned at him.
"Supervisory Agent Donald Kerrigan. Miss Hauptmann, I would advise you not to resist arrest. That will only add to your troubles.
Allow me to clarify matters before this goes too much further, gentlemen, said Jenny. Agent Orton, Agent Kent, Mr. and Mrs. Hauptmann, this is Larry Torbett, Ph.D. Dr. Torbett is teaching a 4-day seminar at WSU Tri-Cities on Fey Human Relations. He retired 2 years ago from a government think tank in Washington, D.C., though the president called him back to help deal with the mess last year when the Fey retreated to their reservations. He was also my law professor, which is why he is staying with me. He asked to join us out of curiosity and boredom, I suspect. She smiled at the continued clueless look she was getting. But the layman would better know him as L.J. Torbett, editor of the Watchdog Times. The Watchdog Times was an influential web-based magazine that wrote and recirculated pieces about government mischief. Recently, it had engineered the forced retirement of a state judge in Pennsylvania, caught giving harsh jail sentences in return for kickbacks from the privately run state penitentiary, and was responsible for the highly publicized trial of a federal official who was spending 10 years in jail rather than the cozy estate in the Bahamas he'd used tax dollars to pay for. The Watchdog Times had also cleared the name of a conservative senator who was accused of having sex with a minor. They hadn't saved his marriage, but they'd saved his career, mostly, and certainly rescued him from a jail sentence when they proved the whole thing had been set up by his political rival, and that the boy in question had been a very young-looking 23-year-old who'd been well-paid to act his part. If he said he had documentation, L.J. Torbett had documentation.
You were asleep when Jenny asked if I'd mind if her old friend joined us, murmured Adam to me. Jenny said he'd thought that it was odd that cantrip agents were first on scene and asked to sit in this afternoon.
I leaned against him and watched the old lawyer-turned-journalist wipe the floor with the cantrip agents.
This, he said, is a disgrace. That government agents who should be above reproach lend themselves to such a scheme is appalling.
You can say what you'd like, said Orton with dignity, but that doesn't change my orders.
Yes, Agent Kent said heavily. Yes, it does, unless you want to be dropped to junior janitor rank for the rest of your tenure in Cantrip. It does. Kerrigan is a political rat, and if he's behind this, he'd sell us down the river without a qualm. If he's not behind it, and it is from higher up, he'll sell us even faster.
Torbett nodded at the younger agent, but looked at Orton when he continued talking. There are larger issues at stake, too, gentlemen. Do you know that the Fey are talking to the werewolves, trying to gain their support for an alliance against the government of the U.S.?
Orton gave a short nod. It wasn't a secret.
Torbett said, What do you think would happen if you forced the Alpha of the Columbia Basin Pack, one of the most prominent packs in the U.S.,
that the humans knew about anyway, to defend his wife against government agents? The man who gave you your orders doesn't understand what he's messing with. A man like Hauptmann, a werewolf, will die defending his mate. He would never have let you leave with her. He tried to tell you that. Did you miss the part where Mr. Hauptmann said he wouldn't let anyone hurt his wife? He gave them a moment to digest that. Then he said, Do you want to be famous, gentlemen? I assure you that your names would have gone down in the history books as the idiots who forced the werewolves into a confrontation with the federal government. He leaned forward. Do you know that Hauptmann has been doing his level best to keep our relations with the werewolves from reaching the boiling point as they did with the Fey?
I think that we are going to regret not eliminating the werewolves while we have a chance, said Agent Kent.
I thought about Bran, and wondered what made Agent Kent think that they ever had a chance at eliminating the werewolves.
Whatever you might think of the legality, Dr. Torbett, I believe this is a matter of survival. Having Hauptmann and his pack under our control would have been the best thing for everyone, even the wolves, Kent said heavily.
Under whose control? Asked Torbett genially. And do you know what they were planning to do with the werewolves?
I do.
I have, he smiled, interesting documentation that is eventually going to see some public servants and an elected official in jail.
It sounds like Mr. Hauptmann is trying to blackmail us, said Agent Orton, his voice gravelly. We can't take his wife in because he'll start a war?
Is it blackmail to tell a child that he'll burn his hand if he puts it in a fire, Agent Orton? Asked Jenny. This is, I think, the same thing.
Orton, said Kent, sounding tired. We are done here. We have orders, the older agent said. No, Kent told him. This isn't the army. We were given instructions and gathered new information that made those instructions unwise.
Gentlemen, said Jenny, I trust we are finished here. If you have further questions, please feel free to call me rather than bothering the Hauptmanns. That's when Detective Willis came in looking exhausted.
Sorry to be late. We found three more dead women and the press has found out about all of them.
He looked at Adam.
We've watched that video and read the letter Miss Trevelyan sent with it. We are satisfied that this Juan Flores is our killer, whatever he is. I'm supposed to tell you that if you have any more information on him, we'd like it, including where he can be found. For my part, I just hope you have more of an idea of how to handle this thing before it kills again than we do.
12. On the way to Honey's, we decided to drive by the house to check on the cat and grab another change of clothing. Warren had left Medea with a mixing bowl filled with cat food and another with water because they'd spent an hour looking for her everywhere. He figured if he couldn't find her, then neither probably could Guayota. There was a cat door in the house, so Medea could come and go as she pleased. If Guayota came and burned the place to the ground, hopefully she'd escape. But I intended to stick her uncooperative rump in a cat carrier and take her with us. I wasn't taking the chance of leaving her vulnerable. I quit worrying about the cat when I saw the car parked in front of the house. A gray Acura RLX, a luxury sedan with horsepower, was sitting in Adam's usual spot. Adam slowed a little.
Do you know that car?
I started to shake my head, then reconsidered. No. But I bet it belongs to Beauclair. I didn't see what he drove, but I heard it, and the RLX fits what I heard. The SUV resumed its usual speed.
He's early, and you left the walking stick at Honey's house.
He can follow us to Honey's.
I won't take him to Honey's house, Adam said. We've already exposed her enough by moving the pack there.
Fine, we can meet him at a place of his choice in an hour. Beauclair was leaning against the front door, reading a book. A battered old copy of Three Men in a Boat. I'd had to read that in college. Twice. Now I couldn't remember if I'd liked it or not. Beauclair looked up when we drove in.
Let me deal with him, Adam said.
This wasn't a John Wayne-esque, let the men deal with the situation, little lady. There was a bit of sandpaper in Adam's voice. He was still unhappy that the Fae had invaded his house and made him sleep through it. He wanted to go establish dominance. Over Lou's son, because that was a really smart idea. While I'd been processing, Adam had already gotten out of the SUV. I shoved open my door and scrambled out, nearly tripping over the walking stick that fell on the ground as if it had been in the SUV and I'd kicked it when I hopped out, which it hadn't been, and I hadn't done. Adam, I said, I've got the walking stick. He stopped halfway between the SUV and the house. He looked at me, and I trotted up to show him. Beauclair straightened, tucked the book in his suit jacket pocket, where it didn't bulge. Either he'd used glamour, or the suit was as expensive as it looked. Adam put a hand on my back as I passed him in an unvoiced request, so I stopped next to him. Beauclair came down the stairs to us, his movements so graceful, I wondered how he had passed for years as human. He paid almost no attention to Adam and me. His eyes were fixed on the walking stick. I couldn't tell what he felt for it, and I expected to. I expected him to be something more decipherable. He stopped several feet away, and for the first time looked at us, looked at Adam.
I will not apologize for coming into your home and making her retrieve my father's walking stick, he said. It was necessary.
If, said Adam, if you had come to my house and knocked on the door, Mercy would still have done everything she could do to find Coyote and get the walking stick back for you. You have, as Lu's son, a just claim on the artifact. If you had done that, matters would have been even between us.
No, said Beauclerc. I would have owed you something for the service you had given me. I will not owe a human for anything.
Substitute slimy toad dung for human, and he might have said it the same way.
Neither my mate nor I is, strictly speaking, human, said Adam. But you made your choices, and so the consequences will follow in due time.
Beauclerc bowed without looking down or losing Adam's gaze. His bow was almost Japanese in all the things it said and didn't say. I accept that there will be trouble between us, though I will not seek it more than I already have. I disturbed your peace deliberately, and the consequences are upon my head. It was a long conversation for such a simple gesture. I held out the walking stick. Here, Coyote said he taught it a few things. Beauclerc looked at me.
I don't know, Coyote, he said. Maybe I will have to remedy that.
Adam's lips curled up in satisfaction.
I would pay money, he said.
Beauclerc, who still hadn't reached for the walking stick, narrowed his eyes at my mate.
Oh?
You never get quite what you expect from Coyote, I told him. He was amazingly helpful this time, so I expect that something horrible will happen to us in the near future. I wished I hadn't said that as soon as the words left my mouth. I already knew that something horrible was coming. I wiggled the walking stick. Would you take this already?
Of your free will, he said.
I rolled my eyes as I repeated the phrase. Of my own free will, I give you this walking stick. And I kept going, though that was the end of the usual phrase I'd spoken every time I tried to give the walking stick back to a fae. Fashioned by Lu, woken by the Oakman, and changed by blood. Changed by death. Changed by spirit. Change comes to all things until the greatest change, which is death. This I entrust to your care. I tried to pretend that I'd intended to say all that from the very beginning. Tried to ignore the way the walking stick was warmer than it should be in my hands, and felt almost eager, as if it wanted to go to Lu's son. Adam knew I was acting. I could tell, because the pressure of his hand on my back changed. Other than a sharp look, Beauclerc didn't seem to have heard anything he wasn't expecting. I wished I knew whether it had been the walking stick or Coyote who had put those words in my mouth. It might even have been Stefan for all I knew. But he should be asleep, and it hadn't sounded like something he'd have said. Beauclerc took the walking stick, closed his eyes, and frowned at it.
This is a fake.
No, I said. Coyote could have passed a fake walking stick to me, though that wasn't quite in his character. But a fake walking stick would have stayed safely at Honey's, tucked inside the locked tack room in the barn where I'd left it. Anger built in his face. And he tossed the walking stick back at me. He didn't mean to hurt me because he didn't throw it like a weapon. I could probably have caught it, but Adam caught it instead.
Are you implying that we are lying to you? Adam asked gently.
He twirled the walking stick like a baton. I put a hand on his and stilled the stick. Thank you, I told him when he let me stop him. The walking stick has been just a little too happy to hurt people lately. He sucked in a breath as I took it out of his hands. Then he opened and closed them a couple of times. He glanced up at the sky.
A few more days until the full moon, he told me.
Werewolves were edgy around moon time. Edgier, anyway. I couldn't help but wonder if the walking stick hadn't helped his anger along just a bit. Mr. Beauclerc, I said, this is the walking stick that Coyote gave me after he showed it how to hide itself better. I left it this morning in a safe, locked in a place miles away from here. It fell out of my SUV just now. I handed it to him again, but I thought that it wasn't as happy to go to him as it had been before. It felt rejected, sulky. Behave, I told it. Adam looked at me. Beauclerc turned it around in his hands, felt over the silver knob, then ran his hands over the stick itself. He half-closed his eyes and did it again. He gave them another of his indecipherable looks.
I told you that I would not apologize, but that was before I rejected the prize I sent you to get. This is my father's walking stick, though it has changed from the last time I held it 1,000 years ago, more or less. I did not expect that it would. His small magics tend to be more stable than the larger ones, which have, up to this point, showed themselves to be more adaptable. He met my eyes. Mercedes Athena Thompson, Hauptmann, added Adam. Hauptmann, I apologize for my disbelief. I apologize for not recognizing the truth of what you told me. I apologize for not listening. He paused, looked at the walking stick again, and his eyebrow rose, almost as if it had said something to him. He gave me a faint, ironic smile. My thanks for retrieving this one from the, he paused, sanctuary that you had found for it. I owe you a favor of your choice. No, I said, no you don't. I know about favors from the Fae. That, he said austerely, is not for you to accept or reject. Information, then, I said. Do you know anything about Guayota? He shook his head. I have heard about your trouble. The Fae do not live on the Canary Islands, and I know nothing more than that he is a volcano spirit taking flesh. Z's young one has been asking around without luck, I believe. He hesitated, gave me a look that said, there is another question to ask me here, but I can't tell you unless you ask. Something about Tad. If I ask you to help us defeat Guayota? He smiled grimly. If I were the Dark Smith of Drontheim, I would offer to help and leave you so far in my debt that you would be my puppet until the end of your days. That's what I thought, I told him, but I needed to ask. Information would be a reasonable balance, he told me. You know that the Smith's son has been requested and required to attend the Fae Court in the reservation, so that would not be new information to you. That there was a Fae Court was new information. I wondered if it was a court in the sense of a court of law, or a more traditional Fae Court, and what the answer to that might mean in the future. But he told me the information he was willing to give us. In repayment of the favor you owe me, is Tad being held prisoner? He smiled as if I'd been clever. I was asked not to speak of this to you, but, as I owe you a favor, I can disregard the earlier request. Tad is unhappy, and those who hold him are not listening. He is being held against his will, but those who hold him don't know Zebolt Adalbertsmeister as I do. He said Z's full name with distaste. I may not like him, but no one can hold such a one as the Dark Smith of Drontheim when he is unwilling. There are too many old Fae who forget what they once knew and believe in the old quarrelsome man they see. There will be no need for a rescue attempt, and indeed such an effort might backfire. You will not be able to contact them, however, until matters play out. He raised an eyebrow at me. I think that there is now balance between us, though I include this as part of our bargain. If you have not heard from the Smith's son in 2 months' time, you may cry out the name you know me by, and I will come and tell you how matters stand. I would not be surprised if it takes at least that long. Then, walking stick in hand, he gave Adam a respectful nod, got in his car, and drove off. I took a deep breath. That's done. Adam shook his head.
Let's hope so.
We collected our clothing, but it took a while to find the cat. Tracking a cat through a field? No problem. Tracking a cat through the house where the cat lived? That was miserable. And, to add insult to injury, when I looked in our bathroom, I found that Christy's shampoo and conditioner were in our shower. She hadn't, however, put her makeup back on the counter. Maybe it was because she took her makeup with her to Honey's house. Adam found the cat eventually on top of a bookcase in the living room, where she'd been watching us look for her. Crouched behind a large copper pot filled with silk flowers, she was nearly invisible.
I gave the flowers, beautiful, dusty gray-blue blooms that contrasted and complemented everything else in the room a little too well, a baleful look.
"Yes," said Adam, petting my cat as he held her like a baby in his arms. She caught his hands and sank her claws into him just a little before her purring redoubled, and she snuggled deeper against him.
"Yes, what?" I asked.
"Yes," Christy picked out those flowers. "The pot, however, was my mother's. Feel free to fill it with something else. If you leave it empty, it collects dust and dead spiders."
His voice was so full of patience that I knew he found me funny. Normally, our bond fluctuated on how much information I got from it, swinging pretty widely during the length of a day. But even within a few minutes, there was some variation, like a swing moving up and down. One second, I was getting grumpy because he was laughing at me. And the next, I was flooded with this mix of tenderness, love, and amusement all mixed together in a potent bundle that meant happy. Hard to get grumpy over that. His smile grew, and the dimple appeared, and I kissed him. I rested my body against him at an angle so I didn't squish the cat and thought, here is my happiness. Here is my reason to survive. Here is my home. "I never forget," I murmured to him when I could.
"Forget?"
"Forget who you are to me," I said, petting him with my fingertips, because I could, because he was mine. "I'll be fretting about Christy, worrying about the pack, hoping Christy trips and spills her carde what's-a-fan-day stew."
"Carbonade à la flamande," said Adam.
"All over the floor. Then I look at you."
"Mm-hmm."
"Yep," I said, putting my nose against him and breathing him in. "Hmm." I was just considering the empty bedroom upstairs and weighing it against the possibility that Guayota would choose that moment to attack when someone knocked at the door. We broke apart. "You have the cat," I said. "I don't want to spend another hour looking for her. I'll get the door."
"Be careful," was all Adam said.
I checked through the peephole carefully, because there had been that one movie on Bad Movie Night where someone had been killed because he put his eye to the peephole, and the bad guy had stuck a fencing sword through the hole and into the victim's eye. We'd stopped the film to argue whether or not it was possible to do, and I remained forever scarred by the scene. It was Rachel, one of Stefan's menagerie, one of his sheep. Stefan was gentler on the people he fed from than other vampires I'd come into contact with. He found broken people, or people who needed something from him so that the exchange, their blood and the course of their lives for whatever a vampire might provide them, was, if not even, a little more balanced. Most members of a vampire's menagerie died slowly, but Stefan's people mostly thrived under his care, or they had until Marsilia had happened to them. I opened the door. Rachel, like Stefan himself, had gained a little weight back. She didn't look like a crack addict anymore, but she didn't look really healthy either. Her skin was pale, and there were shadows in her eyes. She didn't look young anymore, and she was around Jesse's age. But she was back in her goth costume. Black lacy top, black jeans, and long black gloves that disguised the two fingers Marsilia, or Wolf, had cut off her right hand.
"Hey, Mercy," she said. "I've been chasing all over looking for you. I assume you know that someone tried to blow up your garage? I gave up about noon, did the shopping and a few errands, and decided to try again before I drove home. This is for you."
She handed me an envelope with my name in elegant script. I opened it and found a lined note card with an address. 21980 Harbor Landing Road, Pasco. And underneath the address, in the same flowery script, "Sorry."
"Hello, handsome," purred Rachel. "Man with cat is one of my fantasies."
I didn't look up. "He's taken, Rachel. Sorry. She's underage, Adam, and you're taken. Rachel, this is my husband, Adam. Adam, this is Stefan's..." His what? Sheep wasn't any word I'd ever used to describe someone I liked, no matter how accurate it was.
"Stefan's." "Sheep is the word you're looking for," said Rachel. "I'd better get going before the ice cream melts. Bye, Mercy. Bye, Mercy's husband."
She turned and trotted out to her car, a nondescript little Ford I hadn't seen before. She waved and took off in a peal of rubber and gravel that made me wince a little as the splatter of small rocks rained down on the SUV. I twirled the card in my fingers before handing it reluctantly to Adam. "Here," I said more casually than I felt. "I think we'd better call Ariana and Elisaveta, don't you think? Someone has got to know how to make werewolves fireproof." Warren met us at the door to Honey's house.
"Hey, boss,"
he said, drawling like there was nothing wrong, but I could tell that he was upset by the set of his shoulders.
"We were taking Gary Laughing Dog to the bus station like you asked, and Kyle says to tell you thank you for making him aid and abet an escaped convict like that when he started having convulsions in the back seat. We pulled over, and he was unconscious, so we brought him back. He hasn't woken up, and Kyle is pretty well resigned to losing his license to practice law."
I gave the cat carrier to Adam and set down the bag of Medea necessities I carried. The cat box and kitty litter were still in the car, and so was my 44 S&W, which I'd retrieved from the house. "Here, you take the cat and Warren. I'll take Kyle," I said. Adam gave me a look. "Sorry, you heap big alpha dog," I told him. "I'll let you call it next time, but I'm right, and you already know it. Kyle will just make you mad on purpose, and Warren will listen better to you than me about relationships because he'd feel comfortable storming away from me when I said something he didn't want to hear. Where is Kyle?" I directed my question at Warren.
"Down the hall, third bedroom on the left, watching over Laughing Dog, who is still unconscious."
He frowned at me.
"Before Christy came, I never thought about how much you manipulate the people around you. It doesn't feel like manipulation when you do it."
"The difference is," I told him, "that I love you and want everyone to be happy. And," I lifted a finger, "I know what's best for you."
"And," said Adam, "Mercy's not subtle. When she manipulates you, she wants you to know you've been manipulated."
I'd already crossed the living room toward the wing with the bedrooms, but I turned around to stick my tongue out at Adam.
"Don't point that at me unless you are going to use it," he said.
I smiled until I was safely out of sight. The door to the bedroom Warren had indicated was shut, so I knocked. Kyle opened the door. I'd seen Kyle angry before, but I don't think I'd ever seen him that angry. Maybe it was because that anger was directed at me. I slipped through the doorway, though I was pretty sure he'd intended to send me on my way, but I'm really good at sticking my nose in where no one wants it. The room was one of those bedrooms that builders throw into huge houses because they know the kids aren't going to get a vote about what house their parents buy. Honey's house was huge. This bedroom was maybe 10 feet by 9 feet. Just big enough for a twin bed and a chest of drawers. I hadn't seen Honey's suite, but I was sure that it wasn't 10 feet by 9 feet. The bed that someone had tucked Gary into was a queen-size bed, and that meant there wasn't room for a chest of drawers of any size, and that Kyle and I were very close to each other. If he'd been a werewolf, I'd have been worried.
"So," Kyle said mildly as he shut the bedroom door, "we're driving to the bus station in Pasco with the guy who had stopped at my house to look for you. Warren, I want you to know, told me that he was a distant relative of yours. I don't know if that's the truth, and at this point, I don't think I care, but I digress. The important part is that while I'm driving Gary to the bus station, I'm still at the point where I trust that what Warren tells me will be the truth. I'm just beginning to get a funny feeling, though, because I can't figure out why Warren has been so concerned about ID. Even to get on a bus, Mercy, you need ID, but everyone has ID. Why is Warren worried if this guy, you know, your relative, if he has ID? I've just finished driving over the cable bridge when suddenly Gary screams in my ear like girl number two in some horror flick. It sounds like he is dying, so I pull right over on the side of the road instead of putting my foot on the gas and ramming the guy in front of me, which is that first reflex impulse I have when someone screams in my ear."
He paused, looking at me. I figured that only a stupid person would say anything until he'd wound all the way down, so I stayed quiet and tried to look sympathetic. Kyle's foot tapped a rapid tattoo as he waited for me to respond. Finally, he said, "Warren gets out and opens the back door like he isn't surprised, like he expected Gary Laughing Dog.
He bit out Gary's name with special emphasis, separating the last name until the laughing and the dog were really two separate words, to break out screaming at any time. Warren whips off his belt and shoves it between Gary's teeth because, Mercy, this relative of yours that we were just going to shove on a bus is having a grand mal seizure. So here I am, busy, worried about what kind of people I'm associating with who are callously throwing a relative on a bus who has grand mal seizures so often that my partner isn't surprised by it, when my brain catches up with what the newscaster on the radio has been announcing. Can you imagine my amazement that Gary Laughing Dog escaped from the Coyote Ridge Correction Center? All this time, when I thought I was escorting your relative, I've really been harboring an escaped convict.
He waited again, but I wasn't that dumb. He rocked forward as if he wanted to pace, but there just wasn't room.
I explode all over my partner because it is instantly obvious to me that you and Adam both knew where he'd come from because you talked to him before he came to my house. Imagine my surprise when I found out that Warren had known, too. I'm the only one left out of the, hey, this guy is an escaped convict knowledge circle.
This is when I could have spoken, after he enunciated his problem, but he didn't stop talking so I could explain.
I told Warren when he lied to me about what he was that I don't like lies, he said. Liars can't be trusted. He told me that he would never lie to me again.
He stopped talking then, but I had no words. I'd forgotten. I'd forgotten how much he hated to be lied to. How could I have forgotten when he and Warren had broken up over it? Not over Warren's being a werewolf, but over Warren's not telling Kyle what he was. They'd gotten back together, but it had been rough. Gary moved his arm over his eyes.
Drama, 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 he whispered.
You shut up, I snapped. Warren and Kyle were going to break up, and it was my fault.
You quit yelling while you're in the room with the guy with a migraine, Gary told me. Look, Kyle, I get you. We've been trying to keep the whole escaped prisoner thing away from you, give you plausible deniability, but that's obviously done. You go call the police and let them know you found me, and I'll go quietly. You'll keep your license, because you called them as soon as you found out, and we'll all support you on that. But if you do, you have to know that it means that Warren and Adam will die.
Kyle's whole body turned to face the man on the bed.
What?
If I'm not here when the pack faces off with Guayota, Gary said very slowly and clearly like people do when they are talking to young children or people who don't speak English, then Guayota wins by killing all the wolves. That's what this last seeing was about.
He pulled his arm off his eyes and squinted at me.
Let this be a lesson to you, pup. Do not deal with Coyote. He'll screw you over every time. Had I had this vision while lying in prison, I'd have let everyone die because, hey, what did I care? Bunch of werewolves, I don't know, bite the big one, big whoop. But Coyote waits until I meet everyone first. I like Adam. He's what an alpha is supposed to be and so seldom is. I like Warren, and I really, really think Honey is hot. I can't just go back to jail, no matter how safe from Coyote, and let them all die.
Coyote?
Asked Kyle. He looked at me and frowned.
Dear old Dad, said Gary. Mine and hers. That's how we're related.
Not mine, I snapped. My father was Joe Old Coyote who rode bulls and killed vampires. The vampires killed him and made it look like a car wreck. If my father was Coyote, then he abandoned my mother when she was 16 and pregnant. If Coyote was my father, I'd have to hunt him down and kill him. My father was Joe Old Coyote, who died on a road in the middle of nowhere in Montana before I was born. He didn't know that he was just a shell Coyote wore because Coyote had grown bored. He wouldn't have left us if he'd had a choice. After he died, my mother had to leave me with werewolves because she didn't know what to do with me and because she was too young to work at most jobs full time. So she left me. And I was a freaking grown-up, so I could just deal. I was happy. My mother was happy. And my father was dead. And if my father was Joe Old Coyote, I didn't have to kill him. Both Gary and Kyle were looking at me oddly, and I realized that I must have said all of that out loud. I cleared my throat. So, yes, daddy issues. Both of us, Kyle. Gary was in jail because Coyote managed to facilitate his breaking the law, then left him to be picked up by the police. I looked at Gary. You know, if you wanted to be really paranoid, you might consider that Coyote wouldn't be excited about having Guayota here in Coyote's playground. You might think that maybe you were in jail so that you were somewhere I could find you when I needed to ask someone how to get in touch with Coyote. He closed his eyes and nodded.
I've had the same thought. But didn't you come find me because some fey dude wanted the walking stick you gave Coyote? He'd have to have manipulated him, too.
I dropped to the floor, because it was just barely possible. Here I'd been complaining about Christie's manipulations, but she was minor league next to Coyote.
It wouldn't take much, right? I mused.
Beauclair isn't fond of humans, and here is one of his father's artifacts in the hands of a human despite all the fey who tried to take it from her. I'm sure Coyote knows a few of the fey who might whisper in Beauclair's ear. I looked at Gary. Tell me I'm just being paranoid.
The thing you have to ask yourself is this, Gary said. Is it Guayota Coyote wants to rid the world of, or us? I can tell you that he won't care if we die. Death doesn't mean the same thing to him as it does to us. Possibly it's a test of strength. Survival is one of those catch-22s. If you live through one of Coyote's games, it delights him, because then he can push you into one that is more dangerous. On second thought, he opened his eyes and looked at Kyle. Please call the cops.
Why were you in jail? Asked Kyle.
Seriously? Do you know how many guilty people are in jail? None.
Gary's voice rose to imitate a woman's voice.
Honest, I didn't kill him. He fell on my knife 10 times.
I saw Chicago, said Kyle. You won't lie to me because Mercy can tell if you lie. And I'm a lawyer, and, current circumstances aside, I'm pretty good at hearing lies, too.
Gary stared intently at him for a moment, then shrugged, letting the tension in his body slide away.
I guess it doesn't matter to me. I could tell you that I got drunk, stole a car, though I'm pretty sure that was Coyote, but I was drunk, so who knows. Then I stole 4 cases of $200 scotch. I'm pretty sure that might have been Coyote, too, but all I remember is watching him opening one of the bottles. Finally, I parked the car in front of the police station and passed out in the back seat with all but one of the bottles of scotch until the police found me the next morning. That, I am sure, was Coyote. If I told you all of that, it would be true.
He looked at Kyle. His eyes narrowed in a way that told me his head was still hurting.
However, the real reason I went to prison was because a few months before I woke up in front of the police station, I slept with the wife of the man who was later my state-appointed lawyer. I didn't know that he knew I slept with his wife until after I was serving my sentence, when another of his clients was happy to tell me.
Gary closed his eyes.
That the car we stole was a police car didn't help.
Gary laughed, winced, then said,
The funny part is that I had not had a drink of alcohol since I went on a 5-day bender in 1917 and woke up to find I'd volunteered for the army.
He smiled and moved his arm back over his eyes.
It's not safe, you see, to get drunk when Coyote might be watching.
He's telling the truth, I said, after it became obvious that Gary was through talking.
And you escaped because you knew that we were about to get hit with some kind of volcano god when we were expecting Mr. Flores, the stalker,
Kyle said.
Gary grunted. I didn't know about Mr. Flores. All I knew was that Mercy was trying to get an artifact back from Coyote. But then somehow this volcano Manitou was going to kill someone, and it was connected to Mercy.
He looked at me, and then away.
And Mercy was my sister.
Kyle rubbed his face, drew in a breath, and looked at the curtain covering the window. Then he said with a sigh,
Plausible deniability, eh?
If you didn't know Gary had escaped from prison, you couldn't be held responsible, I said. Warren was pretty mad at us for putting you into a situation that could hurt you like that.
Adam told him that he'd take care of you and see that you wouldn't get hurt.
And if you go with the pack to deal with Guayota, Kyle said to Gary, Warren survives.
Gary shook his head very slowly, like it hurt.
Not how it works. All I know is that if I don't go, they all die. Maybe if I go, we all of us die much more horribly than they would have otherwise.
He moved his arm so he could see Kyle's face and grimaced.
Yes, I recognize that expression. Anyone who deals with Coyote wears that expression eventually, and no, I don't know why my going makes a difference.
Kyle stretched his neck to relieve tension and gave a miserable half laugh.
I suppose if Warren's possible death makes me feel like this, I should give him the benefit of the doubt, right?
People make mistakes, I said, even people we love.
Hell of it is. I'm not sure where the mistake was, said Kyle. Not killing Coyote the first time I saw him, said Gary. Not that he'd have stayed dead, but I think the experience might have made the rest of my life more bearable.
Kyle, I said, I love you like a brother. Go out and make up with Warren before he heads out to try to get himself killed. Christy made dinner with Lucia's and Daryl's help. Baked herb and flour-encrusted stuffed chicken. I ate it and had seconds. It was very good, and right now I was too scared to be jealous. Honey didn't have a table big enough to seat the whole pack, and Adam had called the whole pack together. Samuel and Ariana showed up toward the end of dinner. Elisaveta could have made a spell to make one werewolf resistant to Guayota's elemental fire magic, her term, not mine, but she would have needed a piece of his hair or fingernails. If I'd stuck Guayota's finger in my pocket, she could have used that, but I didn't think we'd have much luck getting it back from the police. Ariana said she could help, with fireproofing, not finger-stealing. We all settled down in the big upstairs room to see what she had to offer. She and Samuel stood in front of the big-screen TV. Dr. Samuel Cornick was tall, compelling but not handsome, and when I was 16, I'd thought he was the love of my life. He'd thought I was someone who might be able to give him children that lived. It was a relationship that was doomed to make neither of us happy, and his father, the Maroc, had seen it before we'd fully committed tragedy, and so had sent me away. For a long time, I'd compared every man I met to Samuel. Adam was the only one who had stood up to the comparison. Samuel's mate, Ariana, stood in his shadow. Where he drew the eye, even in a crowded room, she could go unnoticed. Her hair was blonde, her eyes gray, her skin clear, and her entire aspect unremarkable. But that was a fey thing. Being too beautiful or too ugly made someone interesting, and mostly the fey would rather go unnoticed. I'd seen what she really looked like under her glamour, and she was spectacularly beautiful. Okay, she said when everyone was in the room. She held Samuel's hand with white-knuckled strength, because she was afraid of us, all of us. To say she had a canine phobia was a masterly understatement.
I command earth, air, fire, and water, though not as well as I once did. That I command fire means that I can protect you, some of you, from this demon god. I don't know how many I can spell. I think it unlikely that I can do more than 10, but probably at least 5. Adam, you should pick the ones you need to take with you in order of the most useful in battle.
Adam nodded and stood up, but before he could speak, Samuel said,
I'm going, and she's already tried out the spell on me.
Adam gave him a look.
This is not my pack, Samuel said to Adam's unspoken comment, but Mercy is part of my family by my choice, and that makes you, by extension, my brother by marriage. I'm going. You don't get a choice.
So the fear I'd seen in Ariana's eyes hadn't just been because she was in a room full of werewolves. Adam said,
I would not have asked, but I'm very glad to have you on our side.
Then he looked around the room, his gaze touching each of us as he spoke.
Guayota is our enemy. He is not our enemy because he hurt one of our own, though he has. He is not our enemy because he violates our territory, though that is also true. He is not our enemy because he attacked my mate. He is not even our enemy because he is evil. He is our enemy
because he kills those who cannot protect themselves against him, because he will not stop until someone stops him.
He paused and took a deep breath.
I have seen him fight, and so have you. I am not sure this is a fight we can win. But there is one thing I do know, and that is that we will not, we cannot, wait around until he kills another innocent. We might die fighting him, but if we do not try and stop him, we are already defeated.
The room was silent, and at the same time it echoed with